Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Commander-in-Chief talk, Obama in Asia, North Korea tests a big nuclear bomb. After a Commander-in-Chief town hall, Hillary Clinton attacked Donald Trump for his continued praise of Vladimir Putin.
What would Ronald Reagan say about a Republican nominee who attacks America's generals and heaps praise on Russia's president?
Trump told Matt Lauer he's got a plan, or will have, to take down ISIS, but it's a secret.
I don't want to broadcast to the enemy exactly what my plan is. And let me tell you, if I like maybe a combination of my plan and the general's plan, or the general's plan, if I like their plan, Matt, I'm not going to call you up and say, Matt, we have a great plan.
And last night, North Korea carried out its latest and largest test of a nuclear weapon.
North Korea said overnight the test was performed on a newly developed nuclear warhead at a remote site used for previous nuclear tests.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Kelly O'Donnell of NBC News, David Ignatius of The Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What are you watching this week? Clinton and Trump at the Commander-in-Chief Town Hall? Obama in Asia? Chicago murders? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Kelly O'Donnell, Capitol Hill and political correspondent for NBC News. Kelly, welcome back to On Point.
So good to be with you.
Also from Washington, David Ignatius joins us, foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post. David Ignatius, welcome back to you as well.
Hello, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, David, and Kelly.
David, take us first to this North Korea nuclear test, if you would. We're told it's the biggest yet. It comes just after the big meetings in Asia this week. President Obama, of course, in China, then in Laos and beyond. What's the significance of this latest test, and what does it say about the effectiveness of efforts by much of the rest of the world to rein in North Korea's nuclear program?
I'd say, Tom, there are two basic points. First, it is the biggest warhead that they have detonated in one of these tests. This is their fifth major test. This was said to have been 10 kilotons, which is a substantial weapon. I think it shows that the Koreans are proceeding deliberately, despite UN sanctions against them, to try to produce deliverable nuclear weapons, weapons that can be miniaturized, that can be placed atop the missiles that they're developing simultaneously, and that soon, early in the term of the next president, the North Koreans are on a track to be able to deliver a nuclear weapon on U.S. territory overseas, not the U.S. continental mainland, but overseas territories. That's something that I know is deeply worrying people at the Pentagon, people in the U.S. military who are preparing options for the next president. What do you do about a North Korea that is developing this capability and shows every sign that it's prepared to use it?
President Obama just condemned the North Korea nuclear test. I mean, let alone if you're South Korea or Japan or China next door, an ally. Is there, David, is there a red line here that is clear in U.S. strategic policy when it comes to how far North Korea will be watched in its development without some U.S. or action?
Tom, I think that's precisely the issue that will confront the next president. What President Obama has done is to strengthen regional alliances to deal with the North Korean threat. Where the U.S. is in the process of installing a missile defense system in theater called THAAD, which upsets the Chinese. But the U.S. says, look, if you want to prevent the installation of this, stop North Korea. So this will have facilities in South Korea. It will be coordinated between South Korea, Japan, and the United States. That kind of defensive measure is ongoing. The harder question is, should the U.S., in concert with its allies, be considering some sort of additional step to prevent North Korea from having the capability that could hit Japan, could hit South Korea, could hit U.S. territory.
President Obama today calling that North Korean nuclear test a, quote, grave threat to regional security, grave threat, and to international peace and stability. Kelly O'Donnell, of course, we had the Commander-in-Chief town hall this week. Controversy around that, the way Matt Lauer handled that. But the North Korean nuclear test makes it clearer than ever why these issues matter. How did that play out in the point of the campaign that we're at now, Kelly? What did you make of these back-to-back interviews that were, what, advertised as a chance to plumb and test each of these candidates on their readiness to be commander-in-chief?
There are many times when a campaign is dominated by the latest barb thrown back and forth, or sometimes it's domestic policy. But for many Americans, the issue of who would serve best as commander-in-chief really weighs heavily on their decision. And for the veterans who their organization really pushed to have this opportunity to talk about questions that relate directly to their concerns, whether it's VA hospital care, whether it is the suicide rate among veterans, PTSD, issues that concern veterans currently serving, U.S. forces currently serving, and those who have left the service. That is a big issue. And I think where you saw the difference is, really, it was style and substance. Hillary Clinton took some criticism for her demeanor in that. She is adjusting that, talking about that as being something she's aware of, that sometimes she can be perceived as less emotional. She demonstrated a command of the facts. And when we got to Donald Trump, perhaps a bit more ease in terms of his on-camera appearance, but less command of the content. He is talking about strong leadership. He got into some trouble making comments about U.S. generals, saying they'd been reduced to rubble under the Obama administration. That is a highly controversial thing to say. You can differ with a sitting president, and most candidates will do that if they're from the opposite party. But that seemed to be a new line, to in one breath praise Vladimir Putin, who is taking all kinds of steps that are viewed as not in the U.S. national interest, and at the same time really being critical of U.S. military flag officers who are, you know, the type of people who generally voters have a high regard for. So this is a heated topic. There's a lot of substance that voters can review, dig at, chew on. But also it's a tee up for the big debates that begin. The series of the fall debates on the 26th is the first opportunity. And that's when we will see them side by side and the opportunity to compare answers in real time, not one half hour followed by the next.
Yesterday, Hillary Clinton went after Donald Trump on that attack of his on American generals.
Last night was yet another test, and Donald Trump failed yet again. We saw more evidence that he is temperamentally unfit and totally unqualified to be commander-in-chief. He trash-talked American generals, saying they've been, quote, reduced to rubble. He suggested he would fire them and replace them with his hand-picked generals.
Trump, in the forum itself, interestingly, spending time praising Russia's president, Vladimir Putin.
He is really very much of a leader. I mean, you can say, oh, isn't that a terrible thing? He called him, I mean, the man has very strong control over a country. Now, it's a very different system, and I don't happen to like the system. But certainly in that system, he's been a leader far more than our president has been a leader. We have a divided country.
David Ignatius, how do you read Trump, praising yet again Vladimir Putin so strongly here? I mean, this comes against many decades of American political wisdom. And then talking about American generals reduced to rubble. I'm not sure what that means, but what's he talking about?
Well, first on Putin, it's been clear really for some months that Trump feels a kind of affinity for Putin. Putin's a tough guy. If you read The Art of the Deal, Donald Trump wants to sit down with other tough guys and make the deal. And he's comfortable with people he sits across the table from often.
He's essentially a dictator. That's what he's looking to break bread with?
I've described this in my columns as the big guys club. I don't want to use the word dictator for an elected American president.
But no, I don't mean Trump. I mean Vladimir Putin, of course.
Putin certainly is an authoritarian leader. And it's extraordinary to hear an American presidential candidate say that he essentially thinks that a Russian leader who has invaded Crimea, who is destabilizing the Middle East with an aggressive posture that's basically confronting the United States, and whose country is accused of waging a covert action through cyber means to interfere in an election process, to say that that person is a stronger leader, in some ways preferable to our sitting American president, I can't remember ever hearing anything like that in American politics. It was extraordinary. Trump does feel that he can sit down with Putin and make deals that will make the world safer, and we're going to hear him explain that, I'm sure, as the campaign unfolds.
Jack Beatty, what did you make of these two back-to-back with Matt Lauer in between on national security, the commander-in-chief role?
Well, I think that with Mr. Trump, a phrase that the Bolsheviks used applies. He is Mr. Putin's useful idiot. That was the phrase they used for sort of Westerners, often leftists, who apologized for the Soviet Union. They were useful idiots to the
American conservatives have used that for many years, thrown it at American liberals.
Exactly. And we saw a useful idiot of Mr. Putin. I mean, he apologizes for him every time he has the chance. He relativized Putin's the things that David was just talking about, plus his domestic excesses, the murders of journalists, the crackdown on opinion, all the rest. He relativized that by saying, well, I could talk about what the bad things President Obama does. That's exactly the kind of thing that the useful idiots of the Kremlin used to perform. Mike Morrell, the former CIA director, said that the Trump was almost an unwitting agent of the Russian state. I think we have to wonder about the un. You know, unless he releases his tax returns, we're not going to know about what financial arrangements he may or may not have with Russian businessmen or others. And the whole question of whether unwitting or witting will be up for grabs.
Certainly plenty of other Republicans coming out talking very differently. Marco Rubio talking about Putin as a thug, dangerous, bad guy. Donald Trump says, hey, he gets things done for Russia better than the American president. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Looking at a week in the news, North Korea tests its biggest nuke yet, a Trump and Clinton town hall, Obama in Asia, Fox settles for $20 million with Gretchen Carlson, no Zika funding. Kelly O'Donnell is with us, Capitol Hill and political correspondent for NBC News. David Ignatius is here, foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. What do you make of Donald Trump's continuing praise of Russian leader Vladimir Putin? Should Hillary Clinton have said we'll never send ground troops to Iraq again, or Syria? Does Gary Johnson survive the Aleppo gaffe? And what do you make of Obama's farewell swing through Asia, of his warning that climate change is now terrifying? Kevin in Nashville, Tennessee. Thank you for calling, Kevin. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks. The point I wanted to make is that as far as Trump's comments about Putin, I don't think he's saying that he praises Putin. The point that I think he's trying to make is in the eyes of the Russian people, Putin has done a better job than President Obama has done as far as uniting the various countries. If you look at polls, some polls indicate that 50% of the population think that President Obama has divided our country. And I'm not saying through, intentionally doing that. It's just the things that he's implemented, his speeches, have really alienated about half of the population. And I think Trump's point is that Putin has done a better job of pulling their country together.
But what do you think about the idea of an American candidate for the presidency in our democracy praising a dictator for his leadership style?
You go again. You're using the word praise. He's not saying that he praises him. He's saying that Putin has done a better job in the eyes of the Russian people as far as pulling them together.
I got it. He's praising him for leadership in that case. I mean, Kelly, does it sound like praise to me? But maybe, what do you say?
I think that Donald Trump is struck by the image of Vladimir Putin. He's a global figure who has been viewed as a strong leader. And he separates that, I think, from the very important underlying conduct in office and the environment in which Putin has conducted this leadership. And I think Trump, based on if you look at what Trump seems to respond to, I think Trump sees that sort of bigger than life imagery attached to Putin and seems to be drawn to that. He will give you the offhanded remark of, hey, it's a different system. I don't like that system. Yeah. But I'm talking about the leadership. I think that Donald Trump has demonstrated over time an inability to connect the importance of what his words mean to ripples and ripples of factors, whether it be policy, whether it be how other nations view the United States. Trump seems to most enjoy stirring up the pot, getting people talking, attention. That has worked for him in many ways in his business life and in the early phases of his political life. But at this late point, when it is statesmanship that becomes a much higher bar to meet, this is where Trump seems to have trouble connecting that what he says has a real-world impact. There seems to be a real gap there in his connecting those dots.
I mean, you stirred up Republicans and Democrats with those comments. Here was Republican Speaker of the House Paul Ryan yesterday in Washington.
Vladimir Putin is an aggressor that does not share our interests. Vladimir Putin is violating the sovereignty of neighboring countries. It certainly appears that he is conducting in state-sponsored cyber attacks on what appears to be our political system. That is not acting in our interests, and that is an adversarial stance, and he is acting like an adversary.
Paul Ryan, and on the other side of the world, yesterday in Laos, President Obama attacked Donald Trump, saying he wasn't qualified to be president of the U.S.
I think the most important thing for the public and the press is to just listen to what he says and follow up and ask questions about what appear to be either contradictory or uninformed or outright wacky ideas.
Outright wacky, says the president. Okay, let's ask questions on both sides. At the Commander-in-Chief Forum, Hillary Clinton said when it came to the Middle East, there would not be American ground troops again in Iraq or in Syria. Here she was.
We are not putting ground troops into Iraq ever again, and we're not putting ground troops into Syria. We're going to defeat ISIS without committing American ground troops.
David Ignatius, was Hillary Clinton credible? Was she persuasive on a strategy for dealing with ISIS?
Well, you have to start by clarify what she means, what we mean by ground troops. We have
troops
ground
troops
on the ground in Iraq and Syria. I've seen them in the last couple of months on travels there. So what she presumably means is we're not going to put main force, brigade combat teams, forces of the size that we saw during the Iraq invasion 2003 and the aftermath. We're not going to do that again. She presumably isn't ruling out the use of special operations forces and the other kinds of training and assisting forces that are there now. Indeed, from what we know, she actually favors a somewhat expanded role for those kinds of forces in Syria. So she's going to need to clarify that. I think in her defense, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to find a military leader at the Pentagon today who would be an advocate for putting in substantial numbers of U.S. ground troops on the order of 2003 and after. You want to find a general who's skeptical about that approach. It's easy. They've lived through it, and they know that wasn't good for the U.S. military and wasn't, in the end, effective. The parts of our current strategy, as near as I could tell visiting many places with General Votel, the CENTCOM commander, are actually gradually having some success in rolling ISIS back in both Syria and Iraq with the limited numbers. So I think that's what Clinton was talking about. But again, she's going to have to be more specific.
Donald Trump was cagey or elusive, depending how you want to look at it, on what he would do when it came to ISIS. Matt Lauer, asked him about him saying he would convene a panel of generals to hear plans to defeat ISIS. And then Lauer asked Trump about the secret plan to tackle ISIS that Trump has long referenced on the campaign trail.
Is the plan you've been hiding this whole time asking someone else for their plan?
No,
But when I do come up with a plan that I like and that perhaps agrees with mine or maybe doesn't, I may love what the generals come back with. I will compete.
But you have your own plan.
I have a plan, but I want to be. I don't want to. Look, I have a very substantial chance of winning. Make America great again. We're going to make America great again. I have a substantial chance of winning. If I win, I don't want to broadcast to the enemy exactly what my plan is. And let me tell you, if I like maybe a combination of my plan and the general's plan or the general's plan, if I like their plan, Matt, I'm not going to call you up and say, Matt, we have a great plan.
Kelly O'Donnell, is that persuasive politically, do you think? Or does that look like you're tap dancing?
The master of keeping every door open. Donald Trump has a point in this limited way. You can argue that a military plan should not be previewed to the adversaries of the United States. Okay, but in a much bigger sense, he is trying to explain to the American voter how he would conduct himself as a leader in military terms, how he would take on a grave threat like ISIS, how he would interact with partners in the Middle East or other allies who might be helpful in this. So, if you really listen again and again to that exchange, it's, is there a plan? Is there not a plan? When I come up with a plan, I'll listen to the generals. He does not want to be nailed down on this. Now, if he were would he convene generals?
Yeah,
probably.
Yeah, yeah.
But is there a plan today? We have not heard one.
Jack, does that sound like a guy who's carefully assessing the strategic requirements of this region and then quietly, out of public view, making a plan, or like somebody who's making it up as he goes?
It sounds like Richard Nixon, who, of course, had a secret plan for ending the Vietnam War in 1968 and never revealed it. This is something. This is a candidate for the presidency who's not telling the voters what he'd do in office.
he's saying he would deal with ISIS very, very...
He doesn't say how, and that's the issue. He has said in past debates, I have heard him say, we might need 30,000 troops out there. What if the generals come to him and say, we need 50,000 troops? Is that going to be what he's going to do? Hillary Clinton has now said, no, I'm going to say no to the generals if they say 50,000. We don't know about Mr. Trump. We do know that in the past he's mentioned numbers of 20, 30,000 troops.
Brendan in Belchertown, Massachusetts. Brendan, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Tom, for taking the call. Mm-hmm. I'm just very frustrated with this. The media's soft touch, and Trump keeps talking about miracles. Well, show us one. Give us one miracle. We were going to have one miracle phone call to Mexico. Is that what we saw?
Yeah.
I'm hearing the panel. They sound frustrated too. We got to nail them down. Let's start getting things tacked down. We're getting ready for the presidency of the United States.
Brendan, I appreciate your call. Kelly, what about it? We've got the main debates coming up. Matt Lauer took a lot of heat for not being tougher in nailing things down this week. Is there a format and a lineup of interlocutors here for these two candidates that will give Brendan satisfaction when it comes to the theater of debate, but also nailing down what candidates actually mean or intend or are saying?
Well, I think moderating any kind of a forum debate or this sort of interaction with candidates is much harder than it looks.
Mm-hmm.
You have, on the one hand, Hillary Clinton, who sort of went senatorial at times and spoke at length with a limited time clock available. So that's a challenge. On the other hand, we've talked about the fact that Donald Trump fills the space with words, and it is not always easy to hold him to account because when you press him on one matter, he flips to the next. It is a challenge. It's something that voters have to evaluate. When we get into a 90-minute format where the two candidates are in the same setting with a moderator, without audience reaction, there may be a better opportunity to try to nail both candidates down on positions. Hillary Clinton's got a lot more experience in this area, and her issues for the debate may be in relatability and trying to convey a sense of her personality as opposed to the competent side of Hillary Clinton. For Trump, he has been a master of salesmanship in his career, and he seems in many instances to say what an audience wants to hear, to say what he thinks an interviewer wants to hear, and to leave doors open so that he can turn back and forth. We've seen that in the immigration debate, where he was the build-a-wall hardliner, and then the we'll decide in steps after we first deport those who are criminal, undocumented immigrants. We've seen him go all over the place, and that's what makes it difficult, maddening even, to try to nail down. And when it's a television program, there's also a clock running. And so do you spend all the time trying to nail down the candidate, perhaps at the expense of other questions? That's a challenge. I'm not an expert on how it should be best done, but those are some of the factors that I think come into play.
A lot on the line here. We're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. John in St. Marcos, Texas. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to bring up a point about Gary Johnson and the whole, you know, quote-unquote gaffe with him forgetting about Aleppo. I wonder why Trump gets a pass on so many things when he's obviously ignorant about these things. And, you know, Gary Johnson gets chastised for, you know, forgetting about Aleppo. You know, you got Mitt Romney, who's essentially endorsing Johnson, and I don't see why more Republican voters aren't really going over to the side of Johnson, who's obviously more knowledgeable and has an actual plan, whereas, you know, Trump kind of wriggles his way out of these situations.
David, thanks, John, for your call from Texas. David Ignatius, what about that Gary Johnson moment this week? Mike Barnicle on Morning Joe asked him about Aleppo, and he just froze. What? Barnicle was incredulous. Is that fair? Johnson said he thought it was an acronym. Is that out of it? What do you make of it?
Well, I thought it was damaging, and it should be damaging. I thought Mike Barnicle's question was entirely fair. Aleppo is in the news almost every day. It is the center of a nightmare that's destabilizing Europe, let alone wrecking Syria.
Yeah.
And not to recognize it, I think, really should concern voters. A man who's running for president of the United States, commander in chief, who doesn't seem to know what Aleppo is, that's a negative. Donald Trump does get a pass in the debates. He is ignorant about many aspects of foreign policy. But I don't think he gets a pass in terms of fact-checking from the media. We have a wonderful feature at the Washington Post run by Glenn Kessler, one of our veteran reporters, called The Fact Checker, and he will award Pinocchios, up to four Pinocchios, based on whether how fallacious a statement is. And after every debate, every session, every statement by Trump or Clinton, we set our fact checkers to work. And I think many other news organizations are doing similar things now. So there's an attempt to really police this area of assertions and call people when they get things wrong. I think the big mistake that Matt Lauer made, I think as Kelly says, it's hard to moderate a debate like this. But the big mistake that Matt Lauer made was when Trump asserted that he was totally against the war in Iraq, at a time when
and always was essentially.
The Washington Post and other news organizations have shown with essentially documentary evidence that that's a false claim, you needed to intervene. You can't let that stand. And I think Lauer made a mistake. I'm sure if we had him on the show, he would say, "Gosh, I wish I'd brought that up." I think holding people, having a fact-based election to the extent that's possible, is crucial, and it's the job of all of us on this show. That's how we're going to really serve our readers and listeners.
Kelly, Trump said this week that he thinks Hillary Clinton just doesn't have a presidential look. You need a presidential look. I was not sure what that was about. There's a tremendous thing in the Washington Post. Alexandra, is it Petrie there?
Petrie.
Put together a lineup of portraits of American presidents across the years, you know, all the way back to Jefferson and Washington, but then Millard Fillmore and Franklin Pierce and James Buchanan, with some pretty hilarious commentary. You can see that at our website, onpointradio.org. Check it out. But Kelly, what about that? She just doesn't look right to be president. What is that about?
Well, Donald Trump has stepped in this very treacherous territory before, when he had Carly Fiorina as a rival among the GOP candidates on the debate stage. Women voters hear that perhaps differently than men. And Donald Trump has been reminded of this before and still does not seem to get that there are certain things that when you describe the appearance of a woman who's in a prominent position, that raises concerns among women who have been told throughout their careers things about their appearance or have been judged in such a way. He may describe it as some demeanor or manner, but women voters, whom Trump is really behind with, might have heard it differently.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. With Rocket Mortgage, you can get approved for a mortgage in minutes using a phone or tablet. This completely online process uses cutting-edge technology to make getting a mortgage more convenient than ever before. Now you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button without the frustration of digging through stacks of financial documents. Info at quickenloans.com/onpoint, equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Apple released its iPhone 7, getting rid of the headphone jack. Here's CNN's Samuel Burke.
The news isn't what the new iPhone 7 has, it's what it doesn't have. An audio port. We've known it for ages, and now it's disappearing, but you'll have a few options.
Smartphone stuff. Pope Francis declared nun and missionary Mother Teresa a saint on Sunday at the Vatican.
Teresa de Calcutta, santa esse discernimus et definimus.
And conservative activist and anti-feminist Phyllis Schlafly died at 92, a tireless campaigner against the Equal Rights Amendment, gay marriage, communism, and four traditional roles for women. Here she was in 2011 looking back on her life.
Politics was my hobby, and I really spent 25 years as a full-time homemaker. I told the feminists the only person's permission I had to get was my husband's.
Okay, we're looking at a week in the news with Kelly O'Donnell, Capitol Hill and political correspondent for NBC News, David Ignatius, foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post, and our own Jack Beatty. You can join us. What did you make of President Obama's farewell swing through Asia? Can you believe Congress can't pass funding to fight Zika? And what are you thinking on the $20 million Fox settlement with Gretchen Carlson on the iPhone with no headphone jack on Serena Williams out at the U.S. Open? Kelly, can you take us to that Zika funding controversy in Washington? I mean, we've got cases now in the USA, transmission here, and yet after all these months, Congress still can't move on it. What's got it held up, Kelly?
This is a classic example of where there is agreement on the idea of providing funding to combat this virus and to meet the needs in communities where it's already a very real concern. So there is broad agreement that needs to be done. Where Congress can get snagged and stalled is over the method of doing it. The House has passed a bill that provides that funding. The Senate has its own bill. That has failed. The reason that we are hearing is that what often happens with legislation, and when it's considered must pass, meaning this wide agreement that yes, Zika funding must be passed, other things get attached to it as a means of passing the legislation. There has to be sort of a package put before the Senate. And that's where it's hung up. So this has become a political battle, one that both parties are utilizing. Democrats are railing against Republicans for stalling on this. The vice president was at Capitol Hill Thursday to make this argument, the quote, do your job argument. Republicans are saying that it is Democrats who are blocking this. I have been told by people in both parties they fully expect it will be passed. It will be attached to some other must-pass matter. Perhaps it's the funding for the government. This is where politics can be very hard to take for people at home because it really is in the negotiating that takes place on Capitol Hill. When there's something as valuable as a must-pass piece of legislation, there is a disproportionate amount of wrangling over what might be attached to it to get it across the finish line.
And everybody trying to put blame for not passing this on somebody else. This is on Wednesday on the Senate floor. This was Democrat Dick Durbin, Illinois Minority Whip, criticizing provisions added to the emergency Zika funding bill by House Republicans.
When women, fearful of becoming pregnant and infected by the Zika virus, were seeking family planning advice and counseling, the House Republicans threw in a provision on the Zika funding bill to block funding for Planned Parenthood.
So it doesn't move. Mitch McConnell, Majority Leader, came right back criticizing Democrats on the blocking of the Zika funding bill.
Why Democrats would filibuster critical funding for Zika control at a time when cases are growing is really inexplicable. Yet instead of acting with urgency to approve funding to combat Zika, Democrats have chosen once again to filibuster it.
Well, call it what you will, but there's still no funding and the mosquitoes are out there. Tim in Detroit. Tim, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. My point that I was calling about regarding Hillary is that she's been protected around this bubble for the last year and a half. I haven't seen any really hard questions now that she's coming out. Her numbers are falling. She's starting to come out. And now some of these hard questions are taking place. This should have happened a year and a half ago. And now it's really going to hurt her, I believe.
Questions around what, Tim? Questions around what, if I may?
Well, regarding using her private server, unsecured server,
yeah.
What allows her to be president? She should not be allowed, because now anybody could have hacked that, and now they could bribe her after she becomes president, and she puts our nation at risk.
But, Tim, I mean, I understand your complaint there, and there's been a lot, but the idea that she hasn't been asked about it? I mean, Matt Lauer spent at least half his time this week with Hillary Clinton talking about exactly that.
Like I said, I didn't hear it a year and a half ago. I didn't hear it 6 months ago.
Yeah.
Now she's asked a couple hard questions and everybody's freaking out.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know about your characterization there, Tim. I mean, Jack Beatty, I think I've heard a lot of questions to Hillary Clinton about those emails. I'm not sure people are satisfied with her answers. In the FBI report on how she handled that was by no means complimentary, but the idea that she hasn't been asked about it?
No, she has, but Tim does have a point. She has avoided, I forget for how many days, 200 days or something, a press conference until yesterday, I think it was the first one.
Yeah.
Has been dodging that kind of questioning, and she's done individual interviews, lots of them, notably a catastrophic interview with Chris Wallace, where she seemed to be denying what the FBI report said about her handling. But,
yeah,
you know, the Washington...
It
was pretty clear. The Washington Post, in an editorial today, really, I think, makes a good point. They say the Hillary Clinton email story is out of control. And they ask, imagine how history would judge today's Americans if, looking back on this election, the record showed that voters empowered a dangerous man because of a minor email scandal. There is no equivalence, the Post writes, between Mrs. Clinton's wrongs, and they are wrongs, and Mr. Trump's manifest unfitness for office.
All right. I mean, let's look at both sides.
Can I jump in on that, Tom?
Yes, Kelly, please.
I think one of the issues that has made the email story so enduring is that there has been a rolling sort of disclosure of information. She has been asked about it for more than a year, but new facts have become available through congressional inquiry, the FBI probe, and so forth. So there are new topics related to it, especially in the area that the caller mentioned about cybersecurity. So there are new things being learned today that we simply didn't know a year ago. And had it been more fully disclosed, had Clinton and her associates been much more out front in the beginning, this might have been something that she had moved past, but that is not how it played out.
No, it's not. Lots of denial there and tough FBI reports. Same time this week, we had this donation from Donald Trump's foundation, the Trump Foundation, to Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi that drew very skeptical eyes. On Wednesday, the executive director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics, Noah Bookbinder, talked about the controversy surrounding that contribution. The watchdog group filed a complaint to the IRS in March about the Trump Foundation gift to Attorney General Bondi in Florida.
A news story comes out saying that the Attorney General's office is looking into this New York State lawsuit into Trump University and related entities. And a few days later, this contribution from the Trump Foundation comes in to a group supporting Attorney General Bondi. It's certainly something that we think ought to be investigated.
$25,000 contribution, as she weighed whether or how she might look at that legally. Kelly O'Donnell, what do you make of this news headline this week?
It is the kind of situation where rarely would you find explicit evidence of a donation and an outcome. So you have to look at the smoke. And in this case, when we look at the public statements of Donald Trump over time, he has talked many times, almost in his braggadocious way, that by being a donor to both parties, he's been able to get some of the things that he has needed as a developer, as a builder, when there's interaction between the private sector and government. In this instance, it was inappropriate, improper for the foundation to make this kind of donation, which is why Trump has had to pay a fine for this. He says he never discussed the specifics with the attorney general in Florida. That may or may not be true. But when people use influence, you don't always have to explicitly state what is desired to have an effect. So it will be hard to know exactly what happened. But the fact that this occurred, the fact that the donation was improper, the timing, those are all powerful signals that voters can consider.
David Ignatius, I want to turn back for a moment, if we may, to President Obama in Asia this week. Of course, for the G20 meeting in China, then on down to Laos, the pivot to Asia, one of the central foreign policy pushes of his terms in office. I want to ask how effective that seems to have been. Here was one big issue he talked about while he was there, marking the U.S. and China together committing to last year's Paris Climate Accord. Here was the president in China.
Just as I believe the Paris Agreement will ultimately prove to be a turning point for our planet, I believe that history will judge today's efforts as pivotal. For the agreement to enter into force, as has already been stated, 55 countries representing 55% of global emissions must formally join. Together, the U.S. and China represent about 40%.
So that's a big chunk of the representation that needs to be there for this global agreement to come into effect. First, David, just on this issue, where does that stand in terms of formally committing? What needs to happen in the U.S.? Is China formally committed? Are these two really on board or just posing for the cameras?
Well, we'll have to see. But I think the public statement that they're joining the Paris Agreement has to be taken seriously. I don't really doubt that China will follow through on that. The Chinese know they have to do something about their environmental problems, or they're going to have a rebellion among their citizens on their hands. I think that this agreement goes into force, if I remember correctly, 55% of the world's GDP, mm-hmm. or some mm-hmm. figure like that, has mm-hmm. to be
lined up behind
agreement.
It.
I'm told that that there's some indication in quiet diplomatic channels that India may now move toward accepting the Paris Agreement and limits on carbon emissions. That obviously would be crucial. So I think that was a positive achievement of the trip. More broadly on your question about Asia and the pivot to Asia, I think Obama got it right at the end of the trip, where he said it's not that people question America's attention to Asia, and there is more now with this policy. They question whether it's going to be persistent. When both candidates running for president are disavowing a trade agreement that is basically the anchor of U.S. economic and, to some extent, strategic leverage in Asia going forward, when both are saying we don't want it, Asians look at that and they think, we may have no alternative but to line ourselves up with the dominant economic power in the region, China, because the Americans seem to be pulling back. And I think that's the question Obama rightly put at the end of this trip. He's going to put it to the country during the lame duck session and try to get the TPP passed. And that's going to be a key test, not just of his presidency, but where we go in Asia in the future.
Let's get a call from Beaufort, South Carolina. Connie is calling. Hi, Connie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been trying for about 20 minutes to get through, and I'm just extremely frustrated with a lot of what Trump says. I'm a retired Army officer. I joined when I was 18 in 1974 and retired in 1999. I served with a lot of people who were veterans of the Vietnam War who were drafted and did not have some medical excuse not to serve, and now where Trump treats out about what do you expect when you put men and women together regarding the sexual assault. How dare he? Men and women have been working together in every field since we've been on the planet, and having men and women serve in the military is not justification for sexual assault being acceptable.
You're talking about his comments, again, in the forum where he indicated he thought that the simple fact of having men and women serving together was a problem, he indicated, in setting up a sexual assault environment.
Exactly. How ignorant. He's got men and women working in his organization. Would he excuse that just because he put men and women together? It's not men and women together. It's a fact about power, control, and dominance over somebody else. And it could be men on men or women on women assault. It's not just men and women. And I just find that his total, you know, misunderstanding of the way the world works, regardless of culture or gender, is abysmal, and I truly think he's unfit to be commander-in-chief. As I said, I served for almost 25 years, and I've never been fired up so much as by Trump and the ignorant things he continues to say. And I think back about, I grew up with a father who was born in 1930, and he used to say we couldn't have a woman as president unless she was through menopause, because God help us if she had PMS. You know, and so the fact that, you know, he says anything negative about, or the press or anybody else about Hillary Clinton, and I'm a Republican, about Hillary Clinton not looking presidential. If she were warm and sweet, she'd be too maternal and soft. If she takes a firm stand, she's too aggressive. Women can't win, and he's just one more, I think, proponent of that. I don't know how to describe it. I'm just very frustrated by
it. Connie, we got it. We hear it loud and clear. We thank you for your service, and thank you for your call as well. Kelly O'Donnell, if that's representative, that the woman problem for Donald Trump persists.
Well, as I indicated before, women hear some of his comments differently than perhaps men, and I think the caller just made that very clear. I wasn't sure what her political views were until she defined herself as a Republican. That's notable. And I think that for women, the hurdle of a first woman president is a significant thing. It's not necessarily a deciding factor for voters I meet on the campaign trail, but when women hear what they perceive to be unfair comments that are not really part of the modern way we should interact, it does touch a nerve.
We're getting in the home stretch here now. These things are going to matter on both sides. I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. Kelly O'Donnell, Capitol Hill and political correspondent for NBC News. Wonderful to have you as always, Kelly. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
David Ignatius, foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post. Thank you for being with us today, David.
Thanks, Tom.
I'll point out that Alexander Petri feature at our website again. Really funny to look at onpointradio.org. Jack Beatty, thank you so much for joining us today. Great to have you as always.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.